Thanks, Doug. Well, no one went for the door, so that means you knew what room you were in. So that's good. Usually when the insurance topic comes up, some people get up and leave, but we still have them coming in. My name's Robert Wise. I want to introduce also Stuart Walker, my colleague, another executive vice president at Emory & Webb. And Stuart has been working with nonprofits for 30 years. So with insurance, so he's long time. And then also Doug Spracklin. Doug has an agency in Springfield, Missouri, Spracklin Insurance, and we are together Ministry Insured working with Teen Challenge. And technically Doug is actually the agency that works and leads with the national office, and then Stuart and I work with several centers throughout different geographies. So I'm glad you're here, and we are going to talk about insurance, but we are going to talk about some things broader than that, more a bit more broad with risk management, and of course, as the title says, liability. Now, I put this on here so that you know we are not the fun police, okay? To live without risk is to risk not living, and ministry comes with risk, right? You're not going to avoid that. I don't think that was Jesus' intention at all. In fact, if you look at the first that followed him, it was pretty rough. But to live without risk is to risk not living. We understand it's not a perfect world. We understand that not all liability can be controlled. We're not looking for anyone to scale back your ministry to the point of six people sitting in a room looking at a Bible. That's not the goal. The goal is to say the opposite of that is as you grow, as you go into these other areas, having a mindset to say, how can I do this that will be stable? How can I do this that brings care and protection to the people I'm bringing with me as I go? And to see, you know, see it happen for a long period of time. I mean, it was inspiring to see the folks that have been working 20, 25 years, 30, 35, 40 years. We want to see that continue on and on. So we're going to get started. If I can, there we go. All right. Now, we do have some Starbucks gift cards because inevitably, we get set up to do our workshop after lunch. And everyone's really, you know, nice, full, you know, you guys had rice and beef and everything else, you know. So we have some Starbucks gift cards. So my lovely assistant is going to help with that. All right. Knowing is half the battle. Do you know who said that? Come on. Who said it? Right there. That is correct. G.I. Joe. G.I. Joe said knowing is half the battle. You were thinking Socrates or, you know, something like that. We're keeping it real here, my friends. G.I. Joe. All right. So G.I. Joe said knowing is half the battle. And in risk management and in liability, there is nothing more true than that. So before we get into it, I thought we'd take a step back because a question that I know Doug gets every week, Stuart and I get every week is, am I liable for that? Can they sue me for that? And to try to figure out where this comes from. So to kind of give some framework around that question, there was a day years ago when people didn't sue nonprofits. And in fact, it was a great day. We've had a church program outside of our nonprofit program for going back 50 years. So we can trace this in our data. And you go back 50 years, people weren't suing churches very often. Today, different story. But right where we stand, right here in the D.C. area, is where it kind of started to break down. So in 1942, there was a case, the Georgetown College versus a lady named Ms. Hughes, who was a nurse there, and she got hurt and sued the college. And it began to break down what was called charitable immunity. It actually was a law that you couldn't sue a charitable organization, or if you did, it was very limited what you could get from them. Well, after that, it began to kind of break down, and I think there's only about seven states left that have any trace of any kind of charitable immunity. So it's really been watered down to the point of, I'm sorry, we're all vulnerable now. So We knew that, right? So in fact, it got to the point where in 1997, some of you might remember this, there was the Volunteer Protection Act. The government was so concerned that there was lack of volunteers within charitable organizations, they actually instituted a new law to help people feel a little better about, this involved the Good Samaritan law, those types of things, but also people sitting on your boards, that they would feel comfortable to do that and not have to totally put all their, you know, assets at risk in doing so. So that was put into place, it passed. But one thing to keep in mind is, although there are some protections there, it really was set up to protect the individual, not the entity. So the board member, not the 501c3. So that came back, it did help a little bit, but unfortunately there were some multiple exceptions and multiple, you know, caveats, and it varies state by state by state. One of the main exceptions that causes a lot of problems is there's an exception in most states about operating a motor vehicle. And it says if that's what's going on, you're on your own. So as you know, as you probably know, if you've been working with your centers of any time, the auto issue is a big issue. Teen Challenge people like to back into things, but so do church people. So I guess, I don't know, something about being a Christian, I have no idea. But all the vans are backing into everything and all that kind of stuff. And we joke about it a bit, but you know, it is interesting to note that the auto exception is, I can't say it's every state, but it's definitely most states. So that's kind of, you know, where, you know, here we are. We're people that have been changed. We're trying to help. We're trying to be obedient. And we're like, why am I getting sued? I'm the good guy, you know, I'm trying to actually make a difference. But nonetheless, because of the place we are in operating, I guess, mostly within the United States, I know we have Global Teen Challenge here too, but for the most part in this room, working within our culture, this is part of our culture. If we were in the middle of the Sahara, I don't think we'd have to worry about it too much, you know, so, but we are here. So moving forward, what makes me liable? And this is really when people ask, am I liable for that? Can they sue me for that? I think some of what people are asking, some of our centers are asking, has to do with these issues right here. And it's basically saying, what is the trigger point that someone can make my life miserable when I either didn't do anything at all, or I was trying to do something good, and they're going to come after me? Well, there's a few things going on here. So the first is called tort law, which you probably know as civil law, and that's the majority. We're not talking about criminal issues here. We're talking about civil issues. So tort law is, I'll read it for us, a wrongful act or omission other than a crime or a breach of contract. Remedy is usually monetary damages. That is the civil suit that gets put in, and your insurance, general liability, or other liability type of policy would respond to it. So that's one. So within the tort, you've got some subsets. Negligence, the most common. So that's where, again, nothing was intended, but it happened. It was a breach of duty. And not to go too deep in the side of this, but basically saying, did you pass the reasonable person test? You know, the reasonable person test would be, you know, did the Hilton leave these cords out in such a way that a normal person would have kind of put them down or pushed them to the side so someone wouldn't trip? If the answer is no, you didn't pass the reasonable person test, and it actually caused a damage, that the breach of duty of not putting the cords down actually caused something, and the damage was the result of not putting the cords down, well, then you were negligent. Intentional tort is more like, I break into Stuart's house, Stuart pops me on the nose, I get hurt, I go to the hospital, he intended to punch me in the nose, but I was breaking into his house. So in that case, in some states, you can still sue, right? Even if though I was breaking in. So in that case, it was intentional, but you know, that's what it is. The other thing is strict liability. This is much less common. Probably doesn't apply to too many centers, but if you're doing something that is just bona fide crazy town, you're liable. So if you own a tiger, I don't care what you do. If that tiger gets out and kills somebody, you're liable. If you have a fireworks factory, you're probably strict liability. Anything that is of extreme, there is strict liability, and that's a hard place to be. Second one is contracts, and I put God is in the details. At one point in my career, I worked for a Jewish firm, and great bosses. And I always heard, the devil's in the details. Isn't that what you heard? The devil's in the details, right? Well, my Jewish boss, who is not a believer, I don't think, he said, God's in the details. And I was like, that's a better way to think about it. That's a much better way to think about it. So God's in the details. And in contracts, we're going to talk about them a little more. The details matter. And sometimes centers can get in a corner based on unintended consequences coming out of a contract. And looking at, it does create liability. And it's a liability that, you know, the center has to pay for. Statutes. Ignorance is not bliss. This is, we see this with a lot of nonprofits, whether it's Teen Challenge or otherwise, where the good news about nonprofits is it's less regulated than being, in most cases, than being a for-profit, in most cases. So there's exceptions. But in that liberation and ability to do things, sometimes we unfortunately step in areas that we weren't aware of, and guess what? We did break a statute and didn't know it. We see that, especially when it comes to HR, employment type issues. Employment law is expanding exponentially. No one can keep up with it. And that's where we see people, they run it again, good people trying to make good decisions, not knowing they've made, you know, an unintended mistake there. So statutes. And then vicarious liability. One thing we've talked on, we've been talking a lot with the national office on, and it's a big point of discussion is, you know, let's call it the poor national office. Sometimes they get dragged in to all the things that happen within all your centers. It happens enough. Doesn't happen every day, but just because they are associated with you, they have a share a name, they are in some sense a resource to you, they get dragged in, they have vicarious liability, and the same can happen to you. So when someone asks, am I liable for that? These are the areas which could trigger that happening, okay? So enough, whatever that is, you know, quasi, you know, armchair legal talk. We're going to try to talk about what it is you're facing. And one thing I didn't point out, but I'll point out now, is instead of calling it risk management, we're trying to call it risk leadership, because you guys are big on leadership. You guys are working to develop leaders, you're working to develop leaderships on your team, and we feel it is a better term, because management often, and there's nothing wrong with the term management, but management often has to do with focusing on the now. Leadership often has to do with focusing on moving into something where you want to get to. And management, you know, it's good and it's checking, is this, but it's often now. And you know, I'm going to speak up for all the brokers of the world. Please be nice to us, okay? Please be nice to us. We're trying. But often what happens is a center gets into a situation, a large claim or even multiple small claims occur, prices go up, everyone's attention comes on it, and then at that moment, it's a crisis. You know, it's busting the budget without question. By putting risk leadership in place, we're doing prehab versus rehab. You know, we're trying to put those things in place that are going to keep us out of stepping on it and getting us to the place to avoid it in the beginning. But to prove a negative is really hard to do. You know, if I said to you, aren't you glad I kept the zombies away last night? You'd be like, well, what do you mean? Well, did you have a zombie last night? No. Well, I kept him away. And it's hard to prove a negative. So people say, well, I didn't have any claims. Well, hopefully today, you know, we'll talk about and look at that these things happen. And so when your broker's working with you and the cost just went through the moon, to the moon, think, all right, how do we think into the future to avoid this and get this so it's not happening the way it is now? So risk leadership. So creating this cycle is really important. And Stuart and I and Doug, we're simple guys, I'll be honest. We're not rocket scientists. It is simple. But you know what? Just because it's simple, it's not easy. And that's a lot of things in life, isn't it? It's simple, but it doesn't mean it's easy. But it is simple. One thing is you need to identify what's going on in your center. And this is, we'll talk a little bit more, but really just sit down and identify. You're then going to take, all right, I've got my list. These are the things that could possibly cause issues for me from a liability standpoint. I'm going to prioritize them. We're going to talk about, you know, how you do that a little bit. Then I'm actually going to do something about it. I'm going to check to see if it's actually working or not. And this is where it gets a little hard on that making the action occur. And then I'm actually going to see if I can make it better. And then you begin to keep going round and round. You say, okay, that's it, Rob. That's all you got. You know, that's the end of the story. But in a way, yes, in a way, no. So we'll keep going there. First, let me stop and ask, did anyone come into this with a real question or something you wanted to share with the group about something your center's facing? Because we want to make sure we address questions on that. And my guess is if your center's facing it, there's probably someone else in the room that they're facing it as well. Anybody have something that you say, hey, I'd love it if we could touch on this? Yes, sir. Okay, that is a good one. All right, that is a good one. All right, I'm writing it down. Drivers. All right. We're going to get to it, so I'm not going to ignore it. I'm writing it down. We'll get to it. Anybody else? Sir. Yep. Okay, yes, thank you. Let me repeat the question. The first question was, the evaluation of drivers in general. Follow-up question was, what about when a driver has a recent DUI? What do we do with that? So we're going to talk about that. Yes, sir. Okay, so their equipment in your ministry being used by your people?
They're using their equipment, but they're helping us in our property.
So they're using their own equipment too, and your people are using it?
No, but our people are working around them. They're just, they're unloading trucks and things like that. And so.
All right, let me, I'm going to come back to it in contracts, because probably the way to handle it is not through an insurance policy mostly, but through a contract, you know, making sure that that's there. But we'll touch on it. So one more time. So they have equipment that, go ahead, say it again. I'm sorry.
They have equipment that they use to help us unload trucks.
Forklifts.
And their operator comes over and helps, helps us.
Okay. All right. Yep. Okay. Anybody else? Okay, those are good. Yeah.
I do have a question on the implications of that last thing. Is vicarious liability and how we can minimize that potential. The potential that may be a problem.
Okay. The vicarious liability comes up in various, it's all relationship based. So I gave the example of the national office. Give the example though of you as an employer and your employee. The actions of the employee, vicarious liability being brought upstream to the entity based on that. So we're gonna get into the employee. That's probably from a local center's viewpoint, that's probably your largest vicarious liability exposure. And we're going to talk about employment issues on minimizing that. So I'll write that down as well. Because you all share the name?
Yeah.
Yeah, it could occur. The details on what happens when a claim gets filed, I'll give you and Stuart and Doug, chime in, but our viewpoint watching this occur for years, there is, you know, the investigation. So the lawyers are going and they're trying to figure out who's involved in what capacity. They also are trying to quickly figure out how to get the fastest money. That is part of it. So they're not going to look for relationships that would be very, very hard to prove. They're going to look for the relationships that make sense and are probably evident. And then they would go ahead and begin that as part of it. So the Teen Challenge of Wyoming, if it has nothing to do with Teen Challenge of Baltimore, this, yes, they have the same name, but the lawyer would not probably go that route. That's
they're still too far afield.
Yeah, yeah. So the yeah, and they're always looking for the deeper pocket.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, and that's debatable, you know. So, you know, on who has that. All right, anything else? Good questions, very good questions. Yes, sir. Okay.
How we can protect our ministry based on those kind of...
So say it again, they're calling you to come into the center.
Yeah, they want to come to a program, but they have a dog service, like a animal service.
Oh, yeah. Boy. Yeah. I haven't seen it pop up in claims yet, but I can see that being an issue. Yeah, that's interesting. Okay. I don't know if I'll be able to give an exact answer on that one, but we'll talk around it and kind of that's. I assume, yeah, like a service animal, right? Or a therapy animal or something along those lines. Okay. All right. Interesting.
Question?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. What about liability toward counseling somebody and then they go and do something, they go off their meds or they commit suicide or something like that?
Yeah, the, you know, without, you know, I would say 99% of the time, yeah, the claim's going to come back to the last people involved. And if that was counseling, that would be brought. Going back to our slide of, you know, what triggers actual liability, they're going to look for negligence. You know, they're going to look for, you know, was... With professional services, it's different. If you're a doctor, if you're a CPA, if you have something where you are held to a higher standard, then that is what the courts look for, that you at least met that standard. So it's not so much the reasonable person test, which is kind of down here. It's, I am a licensed professional counselor. Did I meet the minimum of what that certification should have done in that specific? If I did, yes, I'm still going to get sued, but hopefully in the wash, you would be exonerated. You know, if you proved that yes, you know, we did everything we did, there was not a breach of duty, professional or otherwise, in that case. So yeah, but we'll talk about professional a little bit too on that. Anybody else? These are great questions. Okay, getting quiet on me. We gotta liven it up here. Okay, so let me do this. Well, first, let me ask you a question. Going back to our risk leadership, if you had to make a guess, do more people die from bowling or from scuba diving? What would your guess be?
Scuba diving,
of course. I mean, they're crazy people. You're basically just trying to survive under there, like breathing through a hose. What's the real answer? Bowling. Even you say, well, that means less people scuba dive than bowling. No, even when the numbers are put together ratio-wise, more people die in bowling than in scuba diving. Why?
Poor physical condition.
Yeah, that could be it. What did you say, sir?
Scuba divers are trained.
Exactly.
Yes.
Risk leadership. It's the training. It's the thinking about and setting up the standards to walk through, they're doing a far more dangerous activity with fewer bad results. And bowlers, you know, hey, we've all gone bowling, right? We just get out there and let her rip. So interesting, right? It shows what managing risk can do in taking a very dangerous activity and making it acceptable. And that's not buying insurance, folks. That's all training. And then not doing anything and the results that can occur. So a little fun fact for you from the insurance side of things. So you want to create a framework to reduce liability. And here's what it is. And I strongly recommend a book. If you haven't read it, it's called The Checklist Manifesto by Atal Gawande. Anybody read that? It's fantastic. He was just named. He's the guy that's going to probably try to fix the healthcare issue. Because you know how Amazon and Warren Buffett, everybody got together and they're going to create this new health situation? Well, guess who got put in charge? This guy. He's amazing. Anyway, his book, okay, so I kind of got ahead of myself, but let me get there real quick. Simply what you want to do is assess your campus. And it is simple. It really is. It is straightforward. Walk through and survey, is the railing loose? Is the rug puckered up? Is the, you know, is the kitchen floor constantly wet and slippery and greasy? Just look for those things that say, all right, what could happen here? When we do our intake, are we actually going through and making sure we're getting all the information we need? And you say, oh my gosh, this is going to take me years. It might. But it is the method by which we get there. So you begin, and of course you can work with your broker, work with people that do this all the time, and they can guide you and create ways to make it faster. Don't just, you know, wander about, you know, taking surveys. But to boil it down to its most critical essence here, because in a workshop like this, we can't go into, well, in, you know, Oklahoma, it's this, and in such, it's hard to do, but to boil it down to the key points and hopefully, you know, grab that is our hope. So you want to do the surveys, physical or, you know, auditory audit things, look at that. But then simply, you want to create lists, checklists. Now, the book called Checklist Manifesto proves the point. And the book is, he is a surgeon. And he goes through the history of where surgeons who... We have a medical malpractice division. I don't know if you work with any surgeons, and if you're related to any surgeons, I apologize, but they tend to have big egos, right? I mean, they're saving people every day, great, I mean, incredible minds, wonderful people, but tend to be a bit arrogant. Well, what happened is he began to put that to drop the death rate from surgeries, and where does that mostly come from? Infection. It was simply a matter of setting up very simplistic lists. Interestingly, if you go to the more extreme cases of surgery, they were the last adopters. Why? I'm surgeon wise. I graduated from Harvard, you know, I don't need a list, I know what I'm doing. But the proof was when the simple lists were put in place, death rates dropped. And the whole book is basically about the idea of itemizing those things to achieve better results. So, great book. It has pretty graphic as far as like talking about cutting things and stuff, but if you have a strong stomach, it's a pretty good book. But it's the same here, not on that level, but the same here. So, we can send this to you too, but set up something that would look like this grid, which is, all right, this definitely is going to happen. In other words, I'm definitely going to have people walking up these steps every day, and these steps are falling down. That's a definite. Okay, and is that insignificant? Is it minor, moderate, serious, or could that be really bad? And you begin to kind of score yourself on where that does. And that helps you prioritize on what to tackle first. You know, you're looking for what can cause me the most pain and what is probably going to happen. That's kind of what you're looking for. So, not rocket science, but hard to do. Simple, but not easy. So hard to do, especially to bring it through. Going through, and this is where I had a good conversation with some centers here, where I heard that they were beginning to adopt some of these things. And they were some larger centers. And they were saying a team, they had developed teams to really own this happening. And if you're the leader, if you're the if you have leadership responsibilities, owning it at the top is key, and then really pushing that down to empower people to do this. And setting up clear responsibility of who responds, and that's key. So when something happens, do you know who's going to speak out on it, especially if it's sensitive, like speaking to the press, speaking to the insurance company, telling the rest of the staff what occurred, dealing with the family. Do you have an exact idea of who talks when and how to respond? And then how they, not just who does it, but how do they do it? Basically establishing those clear accountability and timelines. And then having that team, and maybe it's several teams, maybe it's a team of one if you have a small center, but that person begin to go through and see, all right, what am I going to do with this liability? Am I going to keep it? Am I going to change it? Am I going to give it to somebody else? Or am I going to stop doing it? That's what that means. And then they just begin to document it. I really didn't want to take up the whole workshop talking about the real specifics of this, because it varies center to center of how that would look. But it's still, the concept is exactly identical across whatever you do. But these teams, in the conversation I started to tell you about, they were saying that they had their multi-campus, and they had begun to kind of track accidents, employee or volunteer, student accident there. And then they had parties at the end of a month or whatever the time period, and the pizza party of whoever did better, whoever was, you know, beginning to do these things, kind of building this idea of awareness. Again, sounds hokey, right? It does, but it's not, and it changes what happens. Because I'll let you in on a secret in the insurance business. The companies are not upset when your premiums get higher. They don't mind it when you get a policy that goes up 50%. So our goal is, your goal is, what do I do ahead of that so that doesn't occur? Because they're happy to take the money. Now, in most cases, they do a good job if something happens, but they are definitely not opposed to taking more money. All right, so we looked at the types of claims that occur within addiction centers, Teen Challenge, okay, and this is what we came up with. And I got some help from one of our national companies to kind of look through some claims. So I broke it into physical injury to others. This is the negligent category and of all different types. And again, it's not exotic, it's not crazy, it's not, you know, something unusual. Guess what? 35% of non-auto, and we're going to come back to the auto because that's a big deal, non-auto liability claims, 35% of all liability claims, excluding auto, okay? All liability claims, all combined. So professional, counseling, sexual misconduct, all of it. 35% of them are people just slipping and falling. Now, look at the average claim amount, $82,000. So if you get one of those, your premiums will go up because the company's going to say, okay, I give you $82,000. Now you're going to give me more to help me pay that back over time. So that's the average claim amount. Now, campus, that's where it's going to happen the most. Also, as you're getting fundraising events, whether it's a golf outing, whatever it would be that you're doing, outreach, those are the other areas that this can occur, where you're doing the outreach in the park, you're setting up the sound system, again, the cables. We've seen that claim many, many times. You know, it's just simple slip and falls. What do? We've kind of talked about it. Weekly inspections. The number one indicator of you having a slip and fall that's going to happen is poor housekeeping. If you have a sloppy center, you're going to have these types of claims. It's just, it's an indicator. It's what goes there. The conditions of stairs and railings and the condition of floor surfaces. If you could focus on those three things, it would make a difference. Statistically, based on the statistics, it would make a difference. So again, not very exotic. Let's get to auto, and we'll go to those, try to get in those questions. What time is it, Stuart? Do we have a... Okay. All right. Auto-related. It's by far the leading claim type for Teen Challenge. We've talked about that, by far. And nonprofits at large. You're not alone in that. So if I put all liability claims together, including auto, non-auto, 36% of them are auto. So the average non-disabling bodily injury claim is 16,000. And the thing that's changing here is, although the number of crashes are declining, the costs are rising because guess what? It's more expensive in the hospital these days. And trying to get that taken care of. Change is attainable, and it comes from the questions that we begin to hear earlier in our discussion. The drivers. What do we do with folks that may not be have been driving for a while or have past issues of driving issues? Your carrier, your insurance company, is going to require a certain level, the DUI issue. They are going to, in most cases, say, if that is the case, we ask you not to have that person as a driver. And, you know, if we, it is hard because of the folks that are on our team and what background may be, that very well could be in their background. Clearly, how far in the background matters. But statistically, someone that has that, you know, all the statistics, unfortunately, are working against them, and insurance works on statistics. It works on, you know, the law of large numbers. So how do we evaluate that? You know, what is a good driver? Going to my friend's question over here, what is a good driver versus a bad driver? Here would be my piece of advice. Do some internal checking on who's a good driver and a bad driver. But also be aware of what's required by the insurance company. So there is some middle ground, in other words. The insurance company is going to say, you know, I don't, you know, it depends on the company, but, you know, if they have a DUI in the last 5 years, no. DUI last 3 years, no. I'm not sure where they're going to draw the line. So in that case, it might be a definite no. Going on what you do about that, I don't have a good answer. Going to the second part of what I was saying is, if you have a driver that has an accident in the vehicle driving, really think hard about not letting them drive anymore. Because it is statistically proven that persons that has the first accident is the one that's going to have the second one. Now, I'm not saying that person is non-rehabilitationable, if that's a word, but that's when you would go into training for that person. So if they're borderline, they just got their license back after being suspended for 2 years and all that, you can do the training. It is setting it up in a parking lot and letting them go back and through. We also talked about, you know, having an assistant driver. That's hard to do if you have a small center. But some, you know, distracted driving is a big issue right now, and people are crashing because of that. So the training. So in evaluating if you have a borderline person, my advice would be have a bona fide, and by bona fide, I just mean have it in writing. This is our training. So that you can go back to the insurance company and you can say, yes, I know Stuart has this in his history, but Stuart has passed this, 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 and this training. And then come back to them and say, would that be then acceptable? I can't say it's always going to be yes, but that is going to give you the best ability to try to get that done. It is hard because I know you're looking for drivers. It's like the classic Sunday school teacher, right? We all need Sunday school teachers, so if you got a pulse, get in there. So the drivers are kind of like that, but statistically, it is true that folks that have had past history may have a similar future history. But you could be the change factor for them. They've probably never gone through driver training. They've probably never had accountability in how they're driving. So you could help develop those new habits, but just be aware it is a change in behavior. You know, I have yes, sir. Yes. In fact, a lot of it's actually required a lot of times. A lot of your, I shouldn't say required. The insurance company is going to ask, are you doing that? Now, if it's a position that requires driving, you know, it would behoove you to do that. 10 minutes? Oh, repeat the question? Sorry. The question is in regards to a driver, what about running an MVR prior to hiring? Let me stop and do this before, you know, the talking head keeps going here. What do you think of that question?
I always do.
So we have a center that does do that.
Same.
Same?
It's
Okay, so yeah, if the cost is acceptable. It's if the person is going to be in a driving position, it might be worthwhile looking at that. Because what happens, and this isn't just in nonprofits, it's for-profits too, the person gets hired and then they can only do part of their job. Now you're in an HR conundrum of what to do with this, and they, you know, trying to find something else to do. I think if possible, if it's cost effective, try to do that, have that conversation to go ahead and do that. So going back to the question on what's a good driver, whatever your insurance company thinks it is, and that's going to vary, but you are the change agent in making them become better drivers. People can become better drivers, you know, they really can. But you have to admit they're not a good driver. And no one wants to do that. It was an accident. And the statistics show people who have one often have more. And if you have two, it's almost guaranteed you're having three. So try to, you know, make that part of, you know, getting that person better in life and all that. On the DUI discussion, I would go to the company based on the merits of training that person again. But that goes back to that reasonable person test. God forbid they crash the van with everybody in it, and then it gets found out, wait a second, this guy or lady just had this, and you're allowing them to drive? Well, you'd then have to prove, well, yeah, I am, and here's the reasons why. And if those are reasons are good, you can stand on that. But that's up to the court and the process by which that goes through. What I'm trying to do in these sessions is you can do the professional route, and they are out there. They're great. Sometimes your insurance company will have specified vendors they work with and can provide some of that with the policy. But you really can do it for free. I mean, you really can set up, this is taking a left-hand turn, right-hand turn, you know, just like driver's ed. And as long as you have it written down and show what you do, it can help. Professionals better. There's online courses people can take. Like I know Great American Insurance, Philadelphia Insurance, a lot of these folks, they have online driver training. Bad thing is, you don't get to be a great driver clicking a mouse, you know? So that helps, and it can be done. Telematics is, you know, the little thing you stick in the car, and it says, they're going 15 miles above speed limit. It works. Your people will drive differently if you have it. End of story. Problem is, it comes with a cost, you know, in getting that done. So telematics is another thing. And I'm sorry, I got to move on there. And if those auto questions after, we can talk about that, because that is the leading one. On the leadership decisions, this is kind of how I categorize the next one. So please don't go back and tell your boss, you're a liability. You know, that's what he said. But leadership decisions is a big deal. And so this would be, you know, leaders within your teams, board, you know, whatever part you're playing. And again, it goes back to that breach of duty. Did they do these things? But this little statistic caught me. I thought that's worth noting. The average cost of a director's and officer's employment practice claim is $150,000. This is for nonprofits. 85% of the nonprofits in the world, or in the U.S., have budgets less than $150,000. So it's a budget breaker, you know, on that. And it's relatively inexpensive. But it really can affect a lot of the nonprofits that are out there. So really here's the parts. Are they governing correctly? Are they making decisions with the duty of care, loyalty, and obedience? That means that they're not, you know, conflicts of interest, that they're making sure that all the financial things are correct, compliance issues, are the funds being used correctly? All those issues come up in these types of claims. You see breach of contract. That's one where a lot of times we see it in real estate transactions, where you know, the land is sold to the developer, there's a change of mind, or the developer gets it. And here's the thing. Developers know more about this world of law than most nonprofits, and the developers can often cause headache. So those types of things. I'm going to jump quickly because within leadership decisions, the biggest one that will cause you a liability claim is people. Employees, students, and volunteers. So it's not, you know, so much all the fiduciary and all that, although that does happen. But from a statistical standpoint, this is 70% of those claims. And it comes down to, you know, how are you treating employees, your students, and your volunteers? How have you put together handbooks? How have you, going back to that list manifesto, right? So the handbook kind of is. What have we done to make sure we do it correctly? I commented before that employment law is bonkers. It's filling our, you know, legal system with all kinds of claims and bogging everything down. It's crazy. But it is the area where there are a lot of statutes in place where it doesn't matter that we didn't know. It doesn't matter that we didn't mean harm. It doesn't matter. We basically violated the regulation. So, American with Disabilities Act, going to the dog question. You know, that's the American with Disabilities Act is an incredibly comprehensive, far-reaching law. It can go very wide. So you've got that, not even on the employment side, but even the American with Disabilities Act. Did you violate it in some way? Family Medical Leave Act, did you allow someone to take the time that they were entitled to? Fair Labor Standards Act, this one comes up a lot, and especially with any kind of center where people are living together and constantly together, because how many hours are you working? Am I working while I'm asleep and I'm in the dorm and I'm responsible for who, what happens in the dorm, all that? So what happens is unintentionally, people will go over the 40-hour a week situation, and then if someone decides to take you, you know, not to court, they just submit a claim to Department of Labor. Department of Labor comes out, and again, it's not a negligence issue at that point. It's, did you do it? If you did, it's a fine. End of story. So it's a little different. You don't have to, there's no proof, there's no court, there's no jury. It's just, did you violate it? You're the good guys. I know no one is doing this intentionally, but the other conversation I had here recently, this was the area that they brought up, this center I was talking to, and they said, we had to get down and dirty with our HR stuff. We had to really hone in on how we were bringing people in, both intake as students, but also employees. To my friend's question about the driver, yeah, MVR, how are we taking them in, and then how are we letting them go? Letting people go is always difficult. Do you have the documentation? So, handbooks, it's simple, but not easy. Reviews, do the reviews, just get them done. And then have a bright line between employee and a student and a volunteer. You folks have this unique intern, you know, situation where kind of employee, kind of student, kind of thing. And I find ways to really put a bright line there, because that could definitely, it's already happening. It is an issue for teen challenge centers of, are they an employee or are they a student? Because the law is different if they're an employee than if they're a student. And depending on the situation, that could be broader or narrower. But these are the, you know, regulations that exist out there, laws that exist that cause issue. Discrimination, big one. And again, not intentional. So whether it's, you know, issues on homosexuality, what do we do? And I know that, you know, Doug and others have done work on redoing the wording within the accreditation, et cetera, et cetera. But that still is there. Have it in the handbook, do the reviews, try to designate a bright line between who's who, and then begin to have your HR folks be aware of where these things can really unintentionally cause you harm. Any questions on that one? Yes, sir.
So
That's a good question. Your last part there, as leaders, yes, sir, Doug.
I can answer that if you want.
Yeah, I would love it, because I am stumbling on that one, because you said, as leaders, what's my responsibility? The question, to repeat in here, someone that would be hourly, good people, wanting to do more, taking work home, getting stuff done, what am I to do about that within the organization? Doug Lance. Yeah, unfortunately, this is part of the cult. I'm sorry, one more question. Go ahead, Doug. I was pointing to you if you wanted to. This is great, and I don't want to squash it. I'll repeat what we've been saying here. Really, the questions are revolving around people taking work offline, the responsibility. Doug Lance coming back and saying, if you're knowledgeable of it, you are ipso facto approving it. And then, therefore, if a client or if they brought the Department of Labor in, it probably would go against the center. And then I think Doug said the laws, rightfully so, you know, really to try to benefit the employee versus the big bad company, you know, right? So they are going to work that way. Not mean that they win every time, but they're pretty geared that way. That's something beyond, I think, what we can tackle here. It gets down into what I said with the HR and the having those rules. If you do want help with establishing that, I mean, Doug's a resource, your broker's a resource, we can provide resources that way to get you. There are insurance companies that have part of your EPL policy is a hotline that you can ask those very questions, and you can call it as many times as you want free. It's part of the policy. Not a lot of people know that. But check to see if your policy has that, because your insurance company is incentivized to not have you have a claim, so they want you to know what's the right thing to do, and they do give that out free. It's not them, it's a group of lawyers and HR specialists that can answer questions. So on that. Real quick on contracts, God's in the details. The big thing is making sure you know who's responsible for what, having indemnification language that's saying, if a claim occurs, you're going to handle it, or if a claim occurs, I'm going to handle it. Trying to figure that out. So definitely, I'm sure you have, you know, your legal folks, your lawyer, you know, looking through it. I would encourage you to have, and your insurance broker looks through it too. They're not going to comment on the non-insurance issues, but they can comment on insurance-related issues and, you know, if a claim were to occur, how would it be addressed? So really making sure who's responsible for what. I'm going to skip granting an additional insured status because we're just about out of time. But what that's doing is giving someone access to your policy or being kind of riding along with your policy. In many cases, it's absolutely the appropriate thing to do, but make sure you understand when you do it, why you're doing it. So be confident of who's responsible for what. All kinds of contracts, leases, employee contracts, professional service contracts. If you're outsourcing to counselors or medical doctors or whatever, you know, do you have a contract there? That's a big one. As I said, we have a medical malpractice unit. It's no joke on the vicarious liability there. So make sure your contracts there are clear in how to handle those things. Construction contracts. If you have work crews and you're subcontracting from another, you know, bigger party, definitely look at that contract because bigger construction people, they love to push it all down on the little guy. And you could promise your first child and not even know it in that contract. So definitely have someone look at that. The last one, this is not showing up yet in the claims to a huge degree, but it is going to. And you've heard it. It's the privacy issue with cyber. If you allow what's called PII, personally identifiable information, and you have a little definition there, it just means that, you know, if you have enough info, name, combined with maybe a license number and maybe their something else, bank account number, that's enough to be, you know, personally identifiable information. And the fact of the matter is, everyone thinks it's, you know, guys in Russia or whatever else, and I'm sure they're involved, but it's this right here. People dropping and losing these, or these right here, these laptops, these getting left or taken or forgotten. Some of the largest ones, there was a... I'm sorry, this is a jump drive. This is just the USB drive. When we lose those, and I lose them just like you, depending on what's on this, could be determined a breach. And the problem is, now there's laws about it. Before it was like, oh, oops. Now, if there was, and this happened with a healthcare provider, there was a laptop with like 45,000 client names on it, and it went missing, and they had to report it because the state says you have to report it. So it's coming. I just put it out there because it's just not pretend any longer. The hack is also part of it, you know, but really it's very simple of really controlling who has access to your stuff. And then, you know, looking at if you've done any kind of training with your staff about cyber, you know, don't click on these links, those types of things. It'll help because they're getting smarter. The hackers are getting smarter and smarter, and the claims are going through the roof as far as just in general, not just Teen Challenge, of course. What question did we miss? There was one. The forklift guy. I'm going to touch base with him after. But anything else? We're at time, so I want to be sensitive. I know you want to get ready. We have two more gift cards. So give me one reason you can be liable off that list. There's a bunch of them. Anybody? Negligence, right here. Negligence was one. All right. And we got one more card to give. And I think... All right, I'm going to make this. We're going to make it easy. We're in the afternoon. Who's in the details? God. God's in the details. Okay, I heard her first. So God's in the details. Amen. That's a good way to end, right? God's in the details. Thank you, everybody. Please, we're available. We'll talk to you, and we want to see you have a great ministry. Take care.